Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
As this show releases, the Kavanaugh hearings are underway. Brett Kavanaugh is up for a lifetime appointment to the United States Supreme Court, the highest court in the land. The headlines are coming in minute by minute. There's no good time to release a show like this because so much is changing. But it's an important conversation, one we should be having, and I'm going to bring onto the broadcast investigative journalist and author Catherine Stewart, who's been following the hearings and the Kavanaugh story very closely. She can speak with authority about much of this to help educate us as to what is going on. Before I speak to Catherine, a quick background. Brett Kavanaugh is a United States Circuit Judge for the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia. He is a Yale graduate. He has a degree in American history. He was at one point a postgraduate fellow who worked under Ken Starr. And of course, Ken Starr was behind the Clinton investigation. Kavanaugh was part of the Starr report, which urged the impeachment of President Bill Clinton. He's a Bush appointee. President George H.W. Bush, 2003, appointed to the U.S. Court of Appeals. He was confirmed to the D.C. Circuit Court in May 2006. And he has been nominated by President Donald Trump to serve as Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. Following Kavanaugh into these hearings, a long track record of extremely conservative, some might say evangelically conservative, voting in the D.C. court in almost every area of policy, and several allegations of sexual misconduct and sexual assault, which allegedly happened in the early to mid-1980s involving several people who've come forward. We'll get into those details in just a few. Kavanaugh currently has the lowest polling rating of any Supreme Court nomination since they started taking the poll. That's according to a September 23rd report in the Washington Times. Now, in relation to the allegations against Kavanaugh, it's a poll taken last week. The numbers just came out. Hemant Mehta at Friendly Atheist wrote a fascinating article about it. According to an NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll taken last week, 48% of white evangelical Christians say that Kavanaugh should be confirmed to the Supreme Court even if the charge of sexual assault is true. Pretty much half of white evangelicals polled said that even if it was proven that he's guilty of sexual assault, he should still be confirmed to the United States Supreme Court. Let me bring on someone who's been following this story and writing a lot publicly about the story in major publications like The Guardian. Author and investigative journalist Catherine Stewart, it is so good to have you.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Our paths crossed a while back with the Good News Club. You had done sort of an expose on these religious organizations that were sort of attaching themselves to taxpayer-funded public schools. And often without the knowledge of parents, they were indoctrinating or trying to indoctrinate children. Is that an accurate way to sort of frame the Good News Club?
That's right. The Good News Clubs are an after-school program targeting children in their earliest years of public elementary schools. They're are nearly 4,000 Good News Clubs in public elementary schools around the country. I want to stress the point elementary. They insert themselves in these schools targeting very young children, and their intention is to convert them to a deeply fundamentalist form of evangelical Christianity. They deceive little kids into having the false but unavoidable impression that their public school endorses a particular form of religion, even though they're after-school clubs. You know, sometimes they'll take place in a kindergarten classroom right after the bell rings and things like that. And it's not compulsory for parents to send their kids to the clubs. little kids cannot make that distinction between an activity that's taking place inside their public school and one that's endorsed by their public school. They think that all the teachers in the public schools are authority figures and teaching things that the schools want them to believe. And Good News Club leaders know that little kids can't make that distinction. So that's why they're insistent on establishing themselves in public schools as opposed to in private religious schools or in churches, which are, widely available and have space for these types of religious activities.
I just consider their whole approach so insidious. Don't tell me that you don't know this is inappropriate. Don't tell me they're not being sneaky.
Yeah, they do feel that the public schools are their mission fields in class. In fact, they say it. I went to one of their national conventions where they said, knock down all doors, all barriers to all public schools, public elementary schools in the country, and take the gospel to this open mission field now. They call them open mission fields. And they view children and describe children as, quote, the harvest. And remember, we're not just talking about their kids. We're talking about other people's children in their public schools. So they know very well that they're confusing children into believing that the public schools endorse their religion. And not to digress, because we've got a lot to talk about today, but very briefly, when a Good News Club came to my children's public elementary school in Santa Barbara, a group of evangelical parents offered the Good News Club free space at the evangelical church that was literally next door to the school. You could walk there in 2 minutes. It was a beautiful church, and the Good News Club leaders declined. They wanted to be in the public school precisely because they know that children will perceive the religion of the Good News Club to be the sort of unofficially endorsed. They'll think it's an endorsed view of their public school. And public schools have a kind of cloak of authority in the minds of children. They think that something that happens in their school must be true, must be what their school wants them to believe. It's a sort of representative of the state, in fact.
I just gave a speech in Minneapolis where I was talking about my childhood in evangelical private school and how Christian nationalism is taught at the earliest ages. God and country, we had private school uniforms with American flags on them. We were surrounded by sort of this mission field to grow up and take our country back, so to speak, for Jesus Christ. And here we have the rise of, or actually the continued proliferation of, the theocrats today, which brings us, of course, to Brett Kavanaugh, who's up for the Supreme Court. You've done some wonderful writing. I've been sharing your articles from the New York Times and for the Guardian. And I know you've done a lot of research on Kavanaugh. It's sort of a white noise that causes many people just to wink out, right? There's so much going on and what's true and what's not. And, you know, the midterms are coming up. And so I just want everybody to sort of take a breath, you know, align your chakras or whatever, you know, align your chi, center your zen or whatever you're going to. Let's talk, Catherine, you and I. Let's talk about Brett Kavanaugh, and you can begin wherever you'd like, okay?
There's so much to say right now, even as we're speaking. There are new allegations that are coming forth, and they're deeply disturbing. And of course, I believe they merit grave allegations merit a thorough investigation. But stepping back from all of this, I think we need to look at, first of all, what the right, the hard right, has been trying to do with the judiciary, and then how Brett Kavanaugh fits into that picture. I just came back from the Values Voters Conference. It's a right-wing conference that I go to every year. Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, boasted that the most consequential action of my entire career was one in which he decided to do something, and that was not to fill the vacancy created by the death of Justice Scalia. So the audience was very clear on what he meant. He was referring to his obstruction of then-President Barack Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. He kept talking about remaking the judiciary. He said that Republicans need to prevail in November's midterm elections. And he said, and I quote, if we can hold on to the Senate for the next 2 years, then we're going to transform the federal judiciary for a generation. When it came to Kavanaugh, you know, they want it so badly, not just McConnell, but many other representatives, speakers at the Values Voters Conference said, it's all about the courts. And Mitch McConnell said, we are going to, quote, plow right through the Kavanaugh confirmation process.
Catherine, what's that like for you? What's it like for you at the Values Voters Summit? Are you just coming out of your chair? Are you about to explode?
No, it's fascinating and interesting. I mean, you know, I've spent a lot of time, not just at the Values Voters Conference, but at evangelical churches where the rank and file are being prompted to vote for the quote-unquote right candidate, they say a lot of issues matter, but how can you vote against life, you know, meaning the issue of abortion? So if you can get people to vote on a single issue or a couple of issues, in the top two in our country at present, actually the top three are abortion, same-sex marriage, and their idea of religious liberty, which is actually a kind of religious privilege, but we'll talk about that later.
I think you bring up a salient point when we talk about painting one party or the other with this wide and broad brush. I'm not in any way a Trump fan, right? But when I hear someone indignantly charge that all Trump voters are racists, I think, well, that's not supportable. I mean, here in the Bible Belt of Oklahoma, red state Oklahoma, I can think of many non-racist people in my family or friends who voted Trump. But for them, anyway, it was like a single issue. I mean, for them, it came down to they were anti-abortion. And so they voted on one issue. It had nothing to do with race. I had other people who bought into the canard that, Trump's a successful businessman. We need an outsider businessman in there. And so that was their one issue. It had nothing to do with race. And while I'm sure you agree that racism is being seen in the sort of white nationalistic uprising that's related to Trump, we shouldn't be painting everyone everywhere with this wide and clumsy brush. It's a lot more complicated than a lot of people make it seem.
That's true. I mean, this is not to discount the undercurrent of racism among some of his supporters. In some cases, it's an overcurrent.
Many of his supporters.
And many of his supporters and in much of his messaging. But there is more of an effort being made, and I've seen it over the years, to kind of bring in people of color who kind of adhere to the right religion or take the right stance on the culture war issues that they care about. And I think it's simplistic to call all of his supporters racist.
After the UN speech, I did really catch that sort of temperature of tribalism, though, you know, and I appreciate the fact that in the abstract to say, you know, we need to look out for the interests of the United States, but there seems to be a very nationalistic, tribalistic vibe mm-hmm. in the Trump era. Do you sense that?
Yes. And I do think in general, it's been conceived of as a white Christian nationalism. Although, as I mentioned before, there are efforts to reach out to Latinos and Black Americans who are agreeing with that kind of culture war and economic right-wing economic agenda.
Let's get back to Kavanaugh. You say before any of these allegations of sexual assault, et cetera, had surfaced, long before that, there was a track record. There remains a track record of some alarming policy positions that Kavanaugh has had.
Well, I think to understand the significance of his nomination, we have to look at how he got to this point in his career. He was from a kind of hothouse group carefully cultivated by the Federalist Society and given the stamp of approval by President Trump's right-wing evangelical and conservative Catholic supporters. They obviously have suppressed a lot of his documentary trail. They've suppressed a lot of his papers. We just don't see all the way, you know, we don't have public access to all of his writings. But the part of the trail that's visible shows the way that he is going to advance this agenda. So there was a time when the wall of separation between church and state, which came from Thomas Jefferson's pen, was part of the furniture of American constitutional thought. But in a recent speech, Kavanaugh actually criticized this idea. He seized on a dissenting opinion, which his hero, his judicial hero, Judge Rehnquist, had argued that the wall metaphor was based on bad history. And he said it was useless as a guide to judging. And then we see this in his cases that he rules on. He had this dissenting opinion in the case Priest for Life versus Health and Human Services. Kavanaugh argued that requiring an organization to fill out a one-page form that would have exempted it from providing contraception coverage for its employees imposed a substantial burden on its free exercise of religion. So he sort of felt very acutely that these priests and nuns, as part of Priest for Life, don't want to participate in offering women comprehensive reproductive care. But then in this other case, Garza versus Hargan, which is, I think, as we speak, it's actually being reheard. It involves an undocumented teenager who was in federal custody, 17 years old and pregnant. If she really wanted an abortion, because who knows how this poor young girl got pregnant. She was insistent that she have an abortion. This was in the state of Texas. She had already fulfilled Texas's incredibly onerous requirements for obtaining an abortion. She had already gone to, you know, have her forced ultrasound. They make you listen to some speech and all this nonsense that you have to go through in order to really prove that you want the abortion. You have to see a doctor multiple times. She had already gone through these requirements. She's saying, yes, I want an abortion. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And he ruled that she, instead of getting the abortion that she was actually entitled to at this point in the state, he wanted the government to search for a sponsor for her, which was basically going to postpone the whole process yet an additional several weeks. And remember that abortion is illegal in Texas after 20 weeks, and this could potentially have put her over the limit, at which point she would not have been able to obtain an abortion. Now, that decision, which was slapped down by the full bench of the court on which he sat. But during this hearing, he actually made a couple of telling remarks. He called abortion a, quote, momentous life decision. And he referred contemptuously to abortion rights as, quote, abortion on demand. Now, that's precisely how religious liberty works today, their idea of religious liberty. They maximize the moral anguish of people whose religion and values they favor, and they minimize the rights and suffering of the people whose views they disfavor. And that seems to be, so he really cares about the poor preach for life because they have to throw out this one-page paper. But he doesn't really care about this poor undocumented girl in federal custody who is pregnant against her will and wants to have an abortion. That kind of shows where his sympathies lie. Now, there are other cases that show this kind of idea of religious privilege. Ted Cruz was sort of asking him about religious liberty numerous times, and Kavanaugh spoke movingly about people who had been prevented from airing their religious views in the public square. But he also endorsed an appeal to, quote, history and tradition in justifying the mixing of religion in public schools or government functions or prayers before public meetings and things like that. Now, he showed no awareness whatsoever that appeals to, quote unquote, history and tradition are really aimed at helping people who can claim that their religious tradition, their religious history is the one that is codified in our founding documents. As the religious right has been, they've embarked on this effort to rewrite our history to conform to kind of Christian nationalist fiction.
They've been using the history and tradition arguments for things like Ten Commandments statues and courthouses and on government property and in God we trust on the money. Well, one of the arguments is we've removed all religious context from it. Now it's only about history and tradition. And I just find this bizarre how eager they are to just sort of, for the purposes of keeping it in play, saying, well, we've actually sort of redacted all the religious symbolism.
That's true. Well, it also sustains this myth that the religious right likes to push that early America had a single religion of Christianity. In fact, if you look at the history of our country, different Christian sects were bitterly divided and very antagonistic from the very start. And also, you know, many of America's founders, like James Madison, for example, were firmly opposed to precedents of church-state entanglement, such as congressional chaplains, which he opposed. We also forget about the 1840s to the 1870s, the 1830s to 1870s, when large numbers of Catholics immigrated to America. It created havoc. I mean, back then, nativist Protestants really opposed the involvement of Catholics in public education. They wanted to sort of prevent them from reading from their religious texts. They wanted public school children to have to read from the Protestant Bible. And, you know, things really came to a head. People fought and died in the streets of Philadelphia. I think 24 people were killed over whose religion is going to dominate in the public schools. And the Cincinnati Bible Wars saw another sort of eruption of these types of disputes. So you can kind of see when in the history of our country, one religion in particular has attempted to dominate or has attempted to sort of commandeer the public resources and the government for the promotion of their religion alone. It's really created an untenable situation, and it's not where we should be headed.
Talking here with author and investigative journalist Catherine Stewart. Betsy DeVos is a big advocate for vouchers. I believe Kavanaugh fits into that category as well. Do you want to sort of explain vouchers for those who are kind of wondering what we're talking about and get into Kavanaugh?
Sure. They're a way of funneling taxpayer dollars to private schools. And a lot of the voucher money goes into religious schools, which are then free, of course, to teach creationism and climate denial and bigotry or contempt toward people of other faiths. You know, religious schools are fantastic, but people have a right to send them their kids to these schools, but they have to fund them on their own dime.
Ultimately, at the end of the day, it all leans to Christianity, right? This is usually Christian schools that benefit.
It usually is, but here's the other problem. Once tax dollars go into religious organizations don't have to adhere to the same financial transparency laws that other for-profit and nonprofit groups have to adhere to. They have to, you know, other nonprofits have to kind of open their books. If they're non-religious nonprofits, they have to open their books so we can see how those tax dollars are being spent. But religious organizations don't have to do that. So you're not just funding somebody else's religion with your tax dollars, the promotion of their religion. You're not able to see how those tax dollars are actually being spent.
So is Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh blurring that same line? Does he want vouchers and evangelism in our schools kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. He's expressed enthusiastic support for school voucher programs, which are, you know, as we said, ways of pretending to reform education. They often talk about vouchers as education reform or school reform. They, you know, give it this label that really obscures what it's trying to do, which is funnel money from the public purse to religious organizations. And in fact, he wrote an amicus brief in the case of the Good News Club while he was in private practice. You know, he supported the idea of Good News Clubs operating in public schools. The idea, of course, is supposedly that these types of clubs are available to representatives of all religions. But the groups, religious groups that have actually tested identical strategies, the Satanic Temple actually tried in 2016, they've effectively had the doors slammed in their faces. So it ends up being something that the so-called majority religion, Christian fundamentalists, have established thousands of these Good News Clubs in public schools. And I think the Satanic Temple tried it with 8 and they were not able to do it. So the idea that there's a sort of neutral forum and that all religions can participate in it has really been proven a fiction.
Anything else on Kavanaugh that strikes you you'd like to share with the audience?
Well, Kavanaugh's record also shows that he supported Hobby Lobby. He endorsed the Hobby Lobby decision, which allowed that corporation to use its religious beliefs to deny birth control coverage to its employees. Now, this is actually part of a strategy to create a world in which there's a civil law on the outside, you know, a civil law that the rest of us have to adhere to, but the real judicial power is held by those who determine whose, quote-unquote, acts of conscience are the correct ones. So let's look at the obvious asymmetry in the way employers and employees are discussed in the Hobby Lobby case. Employees are obligated by law to accept health insurance from companies that they work for. So as one member of the company's purchasing pool, each employee is forced to bend his or her will to their sourcing operation, which allows the company to negotiate cheaper rates for group insurance. So does this make employees morally complicit in whatever decision their employer is making? Obviously not. Like, say, this for instance, this is just a complete theoretical. I might not approve of, say, Viagra for unmarried men. If I'm super religious, I might say, well, I don't want to be, you know, supporting sexual activity among men who are unmarried. So Viagra should be off limits. But if I'm working in a company and if my employer's health insurance carrier chooses to cover it, am I complicit in this immoral behavior? Absolutely not. And yet, in the Hobby Lobby case, the court rules that employers are morally complicit in reproductive care coverage that its employees might need. So you see, there's this deep asymmetry here. You're sort of, in this case, saying that the conscience of the employers and the corporation has a conscience, and that conscience is much more important than the conscience of the employees. This kind of asymmetry is visible in a lot of discussion around religious liberty that we are seeing today. So when a pharmacist, for instance, refuses to fill a prescription on the basis of his own religious beliefs, which happened, I think, in Arizona, well, according to today's Christian nationalists, that's an example of religious liberty. But it is not. What about the person whose religious and moral conscience allows her to obtain a prescription for birth control? Her religious conscience is being overruled then by this pharmacist who's saying, well, my religious conscience trumps yours. If you're a woman and you're having a miscarriage and you go to a Catholic hospital, they can delay or refuse to perform a legal and medically indicated procedure on the basis of their religious directives. So basically, the Catholic bishops were sort of determining what procedure a Catholic hospital is morally able to perform. His rights trump the rights of a woman who is hemorrhaging in miscarriage and needs a DNC. I mean, this has happened and happens over and over and over in our country. I actually served as an investigator for a report that was put out by the ACLU on maternal outcomes at Catholic hospitals. We weren't looking at the issue of abortion at all. We were looking at what happens to women who suffer pregnancy complications, such as miscarriage or sepsis or things like that. And what we found was that a shocking number of women go into Catholic hospitals expecting to receive medically indicated best practices care, and their doctors are prevented from delivering that care because of the religious directives at those Catholic hospitals. So this is obviously the rights, some religious rights, trumping and other religious and moral rights. They call that religious liberty, but I think we should call it by its true name, which is religious privilege. Christian nationalists today want the ability to override the law only where it conflicts with their religious beliefs, and thus to withdraw from the social contract that binds the rest of us together as a nation.
You're watching the hearings play out, probably taking copious notes. Can we talk about the accusations and the implications? What are your thoughts?
What we can see, unfortunately, is that Kavanaugh has a history of lying and denial. The allegations were already deeply concerning to me because multiple members of his people who went to college with him said, well, I mean, what he's saying about his drinking is just not true. I saw him drunk. I saw him blind, stumbling drunk.
And if I may, let me interject here with the three specific allegations that we're looking at so far. We've got Dr. Christine Ford. She said back in the 80s, the early 1980s, she was 15. Kavanaugh was 17. They were at a gathering of teenagers. Kavanaugh and a friend were both, quote, stumbling drunk, forced her into a bedroom. While his friend watched, she said he pinned her to a bed on her back and groped her over her clothes, grinding his body against hers and clumsily attempting to pull off her one-piece bathing suit and the clothing she wore over it. When she tried to scream, he put his hand over her mouth. She eventually escaped the room. The second allegation, a woman named Deborah Ramirez, she told The New Yorker 35 years ago at Yale University that Brett Kavanaugh exposed himself at a drunken dormitory party and he thrust his genitals in her face and caused her to touch it without her consent as she pushed him away. She said he had been drinking alcohol. And then Julie Swetnick, her sworn declaration says in 1981 through 1983, she observed Brett Kavanaugh drinking excessively at house parties and engaging in what she called, quote, abusive and physically aggressive behavior toward girls. She claimed Kavanaugh and others would get girls inebriated so they could be, quote, gang raped in side rooms at house parties by a, quote, train of numerous boys. She added in 1982 she was herself a victim of gang rape and Kavanaugh was present on that date. The allegations are hugely serious, and yet, as you say, McConnell and company just want to push this nomination through without even hitting the pause button.
We haven't had an investigation, and we need, and by the way, what are they so afraid of? What about this Mike Judge, I think is his name, this friend of Kavanaugh's who's like, you know, his best buddy and, you know, is now in hiding. And I really think his record is should be disqualifying enough. And then the allegations on top of it, it's just over the top.
Catherine, let's talk about the larger picture. Midterms coming up. The country's in a weird place, weirder than I can ever remember it. And that's saying something. Do you read the headlines and, you know, wonder if we're just in the twilight zone? What's going on in your head when you see all these things transpiring?
I think that the religious right has backed itself into a little bit of a corner, and I'm going to tell you why. I think that they've noticed that they don't have the majority of the public behind them. That's why they're so intent on grabbing the courts. That's why they're so intent on holding onto their power by any means necessary through whether it's gerrymandering or, in this case of this Kavanaugh appointment, trying to sort of force through his appointment without hearing. And I think that, you know, it's really all about the vote. if we can turn out the vote in the numbers, in the right numbers, then we can defeat their agenda. I was at a seminar at the Values Voters given by George Barna. He's an evangelical pollster. And they talked about a cohort of evangelical voters they call sage cons, and that's hyper politically engaged true warriors for their cause. And they vote in extraordinarily large numbers. They vote at a 91% rate. 91% of them vote. And 93% of those, I think, voted for Trump. Now, we don't emphasize the vote the way they do. We need to get younger people out to vote, really work on, you know, turning out our base. There have been so many articles about, you know, how can we flip Republican voters? Well, there's a certain number of people we're not going to flip their vote, but there are also a lot of people who agree with progressives and liberals and centrists on many of these issues. They have a positive view of religious liberty as freedom of conscience for all, but also recognize that the rule of law should apply to everyone, regardless of your, you know, whatever your religious beliefs may happen to be. And we need to get our people out to vote.
Catherine, I know that your website used to be thegoodnewsclub.com. Is there a better way for people to connect with you and your work? I'd like for those interested to be able to sort of follow your stuff.
I'm presently redesigning my website. So you can follow my work on my Twitter feed, which is Kath S. Stewart, K-A-T-H-S-S-T-E-W-A-R-T. I've not been tweeting a lot because I'm working on a new book about the rise of the religious right for Bloomsbury Publishing. It should be coming out in 2020. And I do tweet out my articles as they appear, mostly these days for the New York Times.
It's probably hard because it's the seas are changing, right? I mean, there's so much happening in this kinetic environment that writing about the right, it's almost like moment-by-moment journalism.
You're right about that. But I'm encouraged that more people are taking this issue seriously. I think for a long time, people didn't really want to look at the rise of the religious right because it involves religion. And look, it would be a much nicer world if we could all sort of respect one another's right to believe or not believe as we choose and have, you know, questions about policy and politics without regard to that private world. But the fact is, there is a group in our society, one group that seeks to sort of rewrite the laws and claim a place of privilege and roll back much of the progress that we've achieved over the past decades. And I think unless we confront that fact, we're not going to be able to really understand what's happening in our politics today.
Catherine Stewart, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. I will put your Twitter link in the description box of this broadcast. All my best on the new book coming out in 2020. And in the meantime, we'll just keep kicking and everybody vote in the midterms. Okay? Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.